brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Soft Rep Radio. We have a special guest in studio today, a good friend of mine, Kamal Ravikant. Kamal's been a guest on the show before. For those of you that don't know, because it doesn't, you would never guess by looking at Kamal, that he is an Army veteran of the 10th Mountain Division, went on to build Silicon Valley startups during the first dot-com boom, and is now a venture capitalist and best-selling author. Rebirth was his last novel, and he has since finished a rewrite, expanded version of Love Yourself, which I just saw the new cover. It looks amazing. And that book comes out
January 7th.
January 7th. So look for that for pre-order, and please give that a purchase. The pre-orders do matter for us writers. And yeah, and Kamal and I were out at dinner the other night, and he had the idea to interview me, which is nice. At least I know it won't be too adversarial. I hope not. And then if you want to follow Kamal, which you should, on his Instagram, it's Kamal Ravikant, Kilo Alpha Mike, Alpha Lima, Romeo Alpha Victor, India, Kilo Alpha November Tango. Still got it.
Man, I'm impressed. I was like in my head trying to do that while you were doing it.
Yeah, still got the phonetic alphabet. Some things you just can't unknow. And then before we kick it off, we've got our Crate Club summer sale going on right now. So if you guys are interested, CCSummer19 is a discount code for the Soft Rep listeners. So check that out. And without further ado, I'll turn it over to Kamal.
All right. So the whole point of this was, you know, look, I've known you now for really, we've been really close for about 3 years now, right? I've gotten to see the human side of you. Like I know your kids, I'm close to your kids. Yeah. I advise your company. You know, we've gone flying together. We've done some stupid things together, have some crazy drunken nights together. We've shared a lot together. And, you know, like you truly are a brother, like someone I know I could call in the middle of, from a Turkish prison and I would know you would come get me, you know?
Yeah. And there are very few people like that, I think, in anyone's life. You can have a big group of friends, but the amount of friends that you can actually call. In fact, there's a big, you and I live in the same neighborhood. There's that big yellow sign that says the friends that you can call at 4 a.m. are the ones that matter, right?
4 a.m. with a bucket of lye and then a shovel, no questions. Yeah, so I've seen this whole side of you. And before I knew that, before I got to know the side of you, I knew the public side of you. I thought it'd be fun to share this side of you that I know to your listeners by actually learning more about you as a friend. You know, how we actually met, which is a fun story, is we both have a close friend in common, Tucker Max. He wrote this really funny books called Assholes Finish First and I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell.
Cold beer.
Yeah, and he's an incredibly smart guy. And these books are, but you know, he's like, look, man, I did in my 20s where every guy wishes he did, and I just wrote about it. And they're really funny books. And I told him I was going to be spending time in New York. And he said, okay, I got a guy for you to meet. You guys are going to go great. So he emailed intro to us. And I remember you replied back. And I remember looking at your signature. Okay, Navy SEAL, flies planes, best-selling author. I'm like, oh, God, this guy's going to be full of himself. You know, like, well, I was like, oh, shit. Like, it's going to be one of those, you know? And we met up for sushi this afternoon. Oh, my God, you were anything but. I sometimes joke at you about your humility, you know, about who you are, what you've done and who you are. And we just hit it off. And, you know, then we bonded over some serious drunken nights in New York.
I remember some of them.
Yes, some of them, yeah.
The one at the Bowery Hotel comes to mind, where I just vanished.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I took a girl and vanished.
It was so funny. We were at the Barrio Hotel, and there's this, you have this thing that you have no fear, which kind of makes sense, but like it's fun watching you with women. We'll be sitting there talking, and then there's these four beautiful women sitting there, and Brandon will just lean over and start talking to them. Next thing you know, he's pulling out his phone and he's showing them photos of his plane and this and that. Next thing they're all around us, and I remember we were like drinking.
At their request, usually. It's not like yeah, whatever, buddy. Like, sure, you have an airplane and fly a plane. I'm like, prove it to us. Oh, here you go.
And man, we were so drunk. And I remember, like, next thing I know, I see you holding a girl's hand and stumbling, like, literally, they're stumbling out, keeping each other basically just steady as, like, and you were gone. And I ended up having to pick up the tag for everything that night.
I forgot
it was a funny night.
Stuck you with a tab, which is at the Bowery.
A true friend, right?
Yeah, true friend. What little I do remember about that night after that moment, especially, was we ended up going to my favorite cocktail bar in the city. It was Attaboy. And man, that place is like a time suck. You walk into the Attaboy, there's no light. It's like Vegas, you know? By the time you walk out of there, like the sun is rising. Like, what just happened to me?
Yeah. And actually, like, thanks to you, you know, like, I've gotten to, like, one of my favorite experiences in the world, you know, like just flying with your backseat in your planes, you know, just like dogfighting with, you know, Top Gun instructors and current Navy pilots and so forth. You know, you're just the kind of, you know, men you surround yourself with. You know, like, I come from, you know, Army was a long time ago for me. I was 18, you know, I did, you know, just a few years and then I got out, went to college. So like my circle is more like all techies and Silicon Valley people and so forth. So it's like, it's great to be around men who've been proven themselves, you know, that don't sit there and bitch and moan about, like, you know, their latte being too cold or whatever. And I really enjoyed this. So anyway, you, right? I read Red Circle, which was amazing. And then, but my two favorite books have been actually Amongst Heroes, which was such a great tribute, you know, to the men that you knew. I remember reading that, just being blown away, like each person's story and who they were, and we lost them. And it's like, you just felt like you felt the loss when you read about these guys. And then my favorite book by you actually is The Killing School.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It was like reading an action movie, you know, and it was reading about the sniper program.
Yeah.
So you were a kid living on a boat, you know, so it's very interesting. You became a SEAL. So you already, you know, some SEALs I've met didn't even know how to swim. You were at home in the water.
Yeah.
What was it? What did you grow up in a boat?
I mean, my dad came from similar, you know, it's like the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, right? My dad was really, really good hockey player in Canada as a teenager, but kind of growing up in this 60s environment where everyone's kind of, and look, I think every generation has their thing, right? Like now it's easy for us to like point to the millennials and try and blame everything on the millennial generation and all this kind of social change that's happening. But, you know, back in with my dad, my grandfather, who lived to 90, passed away last year, is amazing, amazing guy, blue collar, Canada Electric guy that worked his way up to white collar, then became an entrepreneur, built a big mobile home resort community outside of Toronto, done really well for himself. But back then, he's just this hardcore 50s kind of guy. And my dad wouldn't cut his hair. And he threw my dad out of the house. My dad went from Toronto to Malibu and lived in Malibu, like burning draft cards on, you know, on the weekends with his buddies.
No kidding.
In the 60s. Yeah.
Wow.
And ran a small landscaping business. Then was driving a Chevy truck up to his place. He ended up living, it's interesting because he was a landscaper and he was living in, I forget, some famous Hollywood person, I believe's guest house.
It was like Cato Kaelin?
Yeah, he was living in this guest house, running his business, you know, landscaping business, growing God knows what else, you know, back in the 60s. And then met my mom and her best friend who were hitchhiking home to the valley, who were like, you know, I think they were 17 or 18 at the time. You know, my dad was like probably 19, 20, and he's like a year older than my mom, but picked him up hitchhiking, ended up getting my mom's phone number, had a relationship with my mom, my grandmother. He's like, oh, come to Canada with me, come to BC, British Columbia, which is like interior BC. Whistler is interior of Vancouver. Where I was born was even more, Cranbrook or Kimberley, British Columbia. It's like really like interior British Columbia, about a couple hours from Banff National Park, really up in the mountains, in the middle of nowhere. he was going up there because there was an opportunity. There's a big mining boom going on and construction boom. And so my grandma's like, well, you can't, you're not going anywhere with this guy, you know, unless you're married. So they got married and he moved my mom to kind of nowhere, British Columbia, Canada. You kind of describe it as kind of like the Alaskan frontier is kind of how I'd put it. You're literally like up in the mountains, streams, animals everywhere. And my dad ended up getting into construction, but I'll do a quick sidebar because it's a funny story. My dad, before he got into construction, kind of self-taught and learned all the different trades, he took a guiding job. He's not a hunter. And I remember he told me this story, and somewhere I have a picture I have to show you. He's at this hunting lodge in British Columbia, and the guy put my, he's like, hey, you want a job? Like these like wealthy guys from like New York and everywhere else are coming here to hunt big elk and deer and bear and all sorts of other stuff. And my dad's like, I don't know anything about it. He's like, literally his first day on the job was the guy's like, here's the path. Just walk this path all day, camp here at night, and you're going to run into shit. Like you're going to see stuff. And my dad was like, okay. And he was like, sure as shit. He's walking down the path, freaking big elk jumps out, bear, like everything he said there. And these guys are like, you're the best guide in the world. My dad's like total greenhorn. But he said that's how he kind of got his start. And he's like, yeah, I would just take him down this trail and like shit would just come out of nowhere, out of the woods.
Well, actually, let's fast forward a little. Yeah. You grew up in a boat and how old were you?
Well, I'll fast forward and I appreciate you as you're being a good host, not letting me go down the rabbit hole. But my dad built a construction company from scratch, built half of the new ski hill in Kimberley. And then during the savings and loans crisis, lost everything. And he was devastated. I remember being 5 years old, six, and we had things. Like I remember, we were poor, and then all of a sudden we had stuff. We had a house on the lake in Idaho, on Kokolala Lake, and it all went away. And my dad tried to fight it, ended up declaring bankruptcy. And he and my mom had always had this dream to sail around the world. We actually had a boat, which we lost in bankruptcy. I think it was a 60-foot Sparksman Stevens, beautiful boat, and we had it in Vancouver. Lost it all. I remember so their plan was, hey, let's do this. Life's too short. Let's buy a boat. It's actually an affordable living solution as well. So we bought a boat in Vancouver. Prior to that, we had moved to Washington State. I actually went to school a couple of years in Washington State, a town called Blaine. And it was humbling for me because I remember, and I can't believe they make kids do this, but I remember having to go up in front of the whole class in third grade and get my free lunch ticket. And I was like the free welfare kid, right? It's just like terrible, to like in front of the whole class to have to do that. But then we bought the boat because, again, my dad was kind of had a really good, he's always been an incredible builder. He followed the construction boom down to California. So we bought the boat in Vancouver, sailed it down to Ventura, California, like got the tail end of a hurricane on the way. It's like, my mom was like, Jesus, is this what we're going to all die at sea here? Off the Oregon coast, we had the tail end of a big hurricane in between Hawaii and the coast. And we literally shut down, like dropped the sails, sea anchor for like almost 2 days, drifted 1,000 miles back, but finally made it to California. And then I lived in Ventura Harbor on a 47 foot catch. I had my own rear stateroom from sixth grade until I finished high school. Looking back, it was a great environment. It was a little, again, you're kind of like people, you go to school and they're like, and the bus came to the harbor and picked us up, but it was still like, you're kind of the boat kids. Uh-huh. And there was a pretty big community of kids that lived on boats in the harbor. So that, I think that made it a little bit easier, but still like, to me, I thought of it was a normal life, but my friends are like, it's kind of crazy. You know, you're living on this boat in the harbor with your family.
Now, how old were you when you joined the Navy?
When I joined at 18. Maybe I joined at 17 and turned 18. I forget. I remember having to get my dad's permission, but I had left home at 16. And I think I did need his permission when I was like approaching 18 and yeah, still 17. Yeah. But yeah, I signed the papers and I wanted to be a Navy SEAL.
So you knew back then?
What I always wanted to do, honestly, was be a pilot. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. And since I could remember, I wanted to fly airplanes. And then I saw the movie Top Gun, which made it even made me even more crazy to fly. Like, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. Mm-hmm. My problem was I didn't have great grades, and I had this weird academic record because living on the boat, like, we took a trip. My parents pulled my sister and I out of school. We went to Mexico for a year. And so I had this like weird in school, out of school, good grades sometimes, just getting by the rest of the time. I was kind of, when I think back on my school, and I remember because I remember when I was writing The Red Circle, I was like, yeah, Mom, I was the draft she was reading. And she's like, I see and hear you're thinking that you're a good student. She's like, let me send you your report cards. And I still have them. And I think we even published them somewhere, but it's like, Brandon needs to pay attention more in class and stop talking to everybody. I didn't have good grades. I was like, oh shit. Like, it's a funny how your mind kind of patches stuff together in history. And sometimes, you know, we remember things differently. It was important. I'm glad my mom made me journal on our sailing trip. So I had the journals to look back on. We had our ship's log. My dad was like religious about keeping a ship's log. So I had some really good source material to look back on.
What made you want to be a SEAL at 17?
So I got a job when I was 12. Thanks to my mom, she comes home. I think she's always trying to like steer me into out of trouble. She's like, hey, this scuba diving boat needs a kid to work part-time in the summer and on the weekends to just help out. And basically you're kind of an intern on the scuba diving boat. And she's like, I already like threw your name in the hat. If you want to go down there and meet the owner and Captain Bill, like, come down anytime. They're going to pull in, you know, this date, whatever. And at the time I had really my first job. My dad kind of nudged me into getting this job, and I fucking hated it. I was the janitor basically. I'd sweep and mop this boating store every night, and it was like for nothing. But I think those jobs teach you a lot of humility, because I knew, I was like, this is not what I want to do.
What you don't want to do.
Yeah, exactly. I go down and I meet Bill, and he was like, yep, you want to do it? Like, be here tomorrow 6 a.m. We're going to pull out for a day trip to Anacapa Island and see if you know, we'll give you a share of the tips, the cruise tips, and see if you like it. And I remember going out there, and all I had to do is like help people with their gear, equipment. When they got out of the water, I'd help them off with their fins. I learned how to fill scuba tanks. I'd help tie the boat up, and I had a blast. Like, I'm like, this is really fun. And then I got like my split of the tips. It was like 40 or 50 bucks. I'm 12 years old. I'm like, fuck yeah, man. I just won the lottery. So I was hooked, and the crew was super nice. You know, they were definitely feeling me out, and not like, and I remember Mike, this Irish captain, was kind of like giving me a lot of shit, and yeah, they were kind of testing me out to see if I had what it takes. And I was into it. So Bill's like, hey, if you want the job, it's yours. So I started there and became a very accomplished diver, like thousands of dives in the span of probably 12 to, you know, 17 when I worked that boat.
Did you find the SEAL dive stuff challenging after this or no?
No. I was always a good diver in the SEALs. The thing is, these kind of dives, and I told about it in the book Mastering Fear, which you encouraged me to write. I remember the first, so the captain, this guy Roger, is one of the captains. He taught me how to dive in the ocean. And it's like the first season I was working on the boat, I remember being at this island called San Miguel, shark infested water. Like there's a big sea lion rookery habitat, and what feeds on them are great whites. Like this crazy Captain Mike had done a great white shark hunt. He got it sponsored to go out there and chum for days for blood. And he was going to jump in the water and spear this great white. Like,
really?
Crazy guy, man. He was crazy. But no sharks ever showed up. Now we're anchored out there for the night. The weather got too rough, so we had to move the boat in the middle of the night. And Mike shakes me awake at 2 a.m. He's like, get your wetsuit on. You got to go dive and get the anchor. And I had done that before in the daytime to speed things up. Sometimes the anchor gets really wrapped up on the reef, and it's faster to send a diver down there and unwrap it. Well, that was like during the daylight and good visibility with like people around. Now it's like 2 a.m. and I'm like, it's like sharks down there, man. And I know the visibility is going to be like barely see your hand in front of your face. I was terrified. But this was kind of like the Navy SEAL training, right? So I had to confront my fear, dive down in the middle of the night.
You're how old again?
I was probably 13 years old.
Okay.
And get this damn anchor unstuck. And it's like the chain is wrapped around this like truck size ledge. We would blast a bunch of bubbles up to the surface. then they would know to pay some slack, and then I would swim it around and get it free. But I'm like, got my dive light, and there's like sea lions whizzing by me. I could tell the bioluminescence are like, and I'm just like, I just want to get out of here as fast as possible. Thankfully, the sea lions were there, so I knew the sharks weren't around. But I did, you know, I got through that, and it's like, okay, that wasn't as bad as I like made up in my head, but it was still scary.
That's a hell of a lesson, by the way. Yeah. It wasn't as bad as you made up in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and so, you know, fast forward, by the time I was 15, I remember taking, I would dive with double 72 tanks. I would be like 80 feet of water at night, shine my light in a hole, and there's like the lobster, the Spiny Lobster Hotel. And I would take a breath. I would take my tanks off. I would take a breath out of the regulator, set it down, and swim in the hole 80 feet underwater and hold my breath and grab as many of those lobsters as I can, like stuff them under my armpits. And now they're going bonkers and they're stirring everything up. And I'm like, okay, where's the way out of here? You know, and swim and put them in my bag and like do it all over again. Like I was just crazy, this the stuff that I would do. And, you know, fast forward, my dad, we went on this big family sailing trip. I had a lot of boating experience. My dad and I were going like just butting heads. I was kind of like the 16-year-old, and I made it as from Ventura all the way to Baja, Mexico, mainland Mexico, down to Acapulco, and then Acapulco to the Marquesas Islands in the South Pacific, then to Tahiti. And then my dad and I had this massive blow up where we almost like it got physical and my mom was crying. And then we just kind of, it wasn't like we had this family talk and said, look, it's, you really don't want to be here. You made that clear before the trip. We think it's time for you to go. And so I was 16 in Papeete, Tahiti, left home. I found, my parents and I both found a boat that needed help sailing to Hilo, Hawaii. It was a catamaran called the Shiloh. And I jumped on that boat, grabbed my backpack and a couple $100, never looked back. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like I wrote about it in Mastering Fear. I cried myself to sleep probably the first three nights, like scared shitless, but I was on my own.
Yeah.
And then, you know, to make a long story longer, I was at the point where I got back and Bill, the owner, he let me live on the boat and finish high school. He wanted me to be a captain. I'd taken all my prep courses to for a 100-ton master's captain's license. I was going to take the test on my 18th birthday, but I just realized I wanted to get out of the harbor environment. I had my best friend I lost to drugs, crystal meth. It was just like seeing him take a nosedive, and I just needed to get out of that environment. Like I knew that. I knew that I had good mentors on the boat, but outside of the boat, my kind of peer group was going really in a wrong direction, and I didn't want to go there. So I looked to the military, and I couldn't qualify for any of the academies to be a pilot. And then I found one of the guys that was a regular on the hardcore trips. We had like a diving version of, you've been to Bones Fest where we fly the crazy planes. We had like a group of guys twice a year that would come together on this diving trip. And we do like 7-8 dives a day. We're typically a normal passenger ship. You're doing 3. Mm-hmm. At night, we're playing poker and drinking whiskey. And I'm like in heaven, right? One of the guys said, hey, have you heard about the Navy SEALs? And he gave me this book called Rogue Warrior.
And, Rogue Warrior.
Yeah,
What's his
Marcinko.
Marcinko, yeah.
So, and we actually had Marcinko on the show before.
Oh, he was a trip.
Yeah, great. Even at, he's in his 70s now. He's still a trip. Great guy. It's sad to see kind of how he's been treated by the community, actually, because he is really a great, he's a legend, you know. And you know, it's a shame to see like the guys, you know, guys are suffering now. I mean, it's a whole nother story we can talk about, but it's a shame to see these guys kind of eating him alive and taking cheap shots when the guy is like a hero and founding fathers of SEAL Team 6. I read this book and then that was it. I was like, this is my way out. I'm going to be a SEAL. I can do this. And I wanted to prove it to myself. Like there was a sense, I always felt more American than Canadian. But I, to be honest, there was this, like part of it for me was great. I get to serve my country. But the selfish part was, I want to see if I can do this, what not many people can do. Like it's 90% washout rate. And so that was a big driver for me behind becoming a SEAL and joining the Navy. And it was a tough road because back when I joined, you could not get a guaranteed contract. So you had to take a job, like a regular Navy job, and then apply once you got into the Navy and into the system. Some guys were like, screw it, I'll be a cook and I'll go to a 2-week school and I'll try out right away. But I was like, at least I think I was smart enough to go, I don't want to go that route because if something messes up, I don't want to be a freaking cook for 3 years. So I took this the aptitude test and scored high enough to get into a couple different programs. And one of them was search and rescue aircrew program. So I got guaranteed aircrewman, search and rescue, accelerated advancement to non-NCO, to E4, and a big bonus. And I was like, okay, I want to do that. Like, that's a cool job in itself. Yeah. You know, in hindsight, because it was an undermanned job, they didn't want to let me leave to go be a SEAL. So I had to really fight to get out of that job. It took me almost 4 years to get to SEAL training, which I finally did. And I joined the Navy in 93 and I got to SEAL training in 97.
How did you prepare for SEAL training?
Oh man, I did not prepare for SEAL training. Other than like, I would say that majority of people that make it through, like they've been prepared through their life experiences up to that point. If you haven't experienced adversity, you're really going to have a tough time and probably wash out training, because the training is adversity 7 days a week. And you have, if you don't have the like personal mental skills to deal with that stuff showing up, you're fucked. Physically, I was in terrible shape. I just got off a 6 month deployment on the USS Kitty Hawk. You know, there's not very many places to swim on an aircraft carrier, let alone even run besides the treadmill. And I had just kind of got along and went on this deployment. I was partying. We're pulling to Australia, Thailand. I'm like, oh, it's my last go around with the guys. And I could do the minimum standards for the entry test. And then when I got my orders, it was 5 months into deployment. I remember I was in the Middle East in the Persian Gulf, and I got my orders. Like, yes, I finally got my class date. And then when I got back, took leave, and then checked into Buds. And it took me about 1 second to realize I was not physically prepared for this at all. And it was hellish. Like the first 6 weeks, my body was destroyed. I was not in shape. I was last group on the runs, last group on the PT. The instructors all knew me by name. You know, there was a thing called the goon squad, where if you don't keep up, you get put in the goon squad. So everyone's drinking water and stretching. After a 6 mile beach run, you're, you know, doing bear crawls up and down the sand berms and jumping in the water. Like, it's just torture. Showing up for 5 a.m., a normal start time of 5 a.m., a PT session, you would show up at 4 a.m. because you're in the remedial PT group. It was terrible, man. So I was not prepared for Buds physically. Mentally, I was. Physically, it was tough. I mean, imagine being, we started 220 with class 215, and we ended with, I think, just over 20, like 23 finished. But imagine the beginning being singled out of 220 guys, and the instructors are like, you're not going to get a break and go get to eat lunch until Webb does another 50 push-ups.
Oh, shit.
You get maybe like 1% of the group is giving you sympathy and some encouragement. The rest is just like, you look around, they're like, why don't you just quit and end the suffering for all of us, you know? I'm like, fucking thanks, guys. But it was it was a tough thing to deal with, because I was an E5. You know, I had some seniority in rank. And I knew that.
Probably older than some of the guys too.
Yeah,
right?
I was, you know, I'd say, you know, the average age is like 19, 20. You know, 21, maybe some Naval Academy guys, but I was, you know, I was like 22. I think I turned 23 in Buds. And yeah, I was, and so being in that situation where, you know, you're kind of dragging, your poor physical performance is punishing other people. It really sucked to be in that situation. But I just knew that early on in that first week where I was going through all this, one of the fastest runners in the class quit one morning. We got up like after a weekend, it was Monday, and he went to ring the bell to quit. And it just dawned on me, is like, that's the fastest guy in the class. Like, why? And I think I forget his name, but you can see his face clearly. Why is he quitting? And I don't know if I asked him or just kind of the rumor mill got back, but it was like, he didn't like to suffer, like the cold, getting yelled at. But he was like, the instructors loved him. He was the fastest runner, always getting rewarded. They'd always call him out by name. Why can't you be like this guy? But at that point, I knew it was mental. I'm like, okay, I just have to suffer through this. And it's a game of like persistence and suffering.
You know, it's the same thing in building companies, man.
Yeah, no
shit. It's the same thing. Yeah. Like, it's like having built companies myself and now invest in, you know, startups and entrepreneurs. In the end, I was talking to a friend of mine. He's like, what is it that, you know, your best investments? I'm like, it's always comes down to the person, the founder. Yeah. And it's like, and when, if I get the feeling this person was born to do this, I will back him or her every single time they do it, whether they fail or not. I want to back them next time, because the person is just committed, it keeps going. Eventually they learn and they hit it. It's funny, right? In anything in life, that's what it comes down to.
No, and I mean, that's my kind of my own story, right? I kind of got out of the military, started this, my first startup, and, you know, raised some money. And even now reflecting, I'm way more, I give my partners way more credit now than I did then, because then you're just like pissed off, you know, because, you know, the business broke up during the last recession, total shit show. And it's easy to kind of blame your partners. But in reflection, it was just, partnership is a lot like being in a relationship where...
It's worse. You don't get laid.
Yeah. Well, then there's that. Yeah. Well, at least in most partnerships.
I definitely
wasn't getting laid. I was maybe getting fucked a bit. But I just realized like they were smart people. Just the chemistry was off. So it's really, I think, really invested all into my kind of knowledge and entrepreneurial journey. It's one of the reasons I went to that Harvard OPM class. I realized that you are who you hire. So you hire for culture and you train. The companies that are team-focused companies hire and train from within. The companies that are kind of like eye-focused, where it's individual-focused performance and they really don't care about the team. You could think about an airline that depicts this scenario perfectly is the difference between Southwest Airlines and United Airlines. You know, Southwest is a team environment. People are happy there. You can tell like where you go to United, it's totally different. And it flows right down to the customer service level. Even when at the last recession, Southwest, I don't think laid off anybody. They did it as a show to their team. Like, we're going to stick this through this together. Where the rest of the airlines were just like laying off a ton of people. The point on partnership is like, really choose your partners carefully. You know the deal. I won't get into it on the show, but I recently went through another thing where I had a side business and just didn't really probably listen to a lot of people and ignored a lot of signs. Where looking back in hindsight, I'm like, man, all the signs were there. Why didn't I see it? So it's just about, you have to choose your partners carefully and then take the blame when you choose poorly and be like, look, I'm as much to blame for this as anybody.
Well, that's a leader. Yeah. Honestly, you know, that's one thing I wish more entrepreneurs and just politicians would learn. Like, ultimately, leader is the one responsible, not the one below, right? So, like, look, you make it as a SEAL, and you were the runt in the group, which is in itself, if you think about it, a great story, right? So, like, the guy who was the shining star is the one who quit, and that's a hell of a wake up call.
Yeah. Right?
So it comes down to mental. It's a mental thing. You just have to, and the mental part, you have to want it badly enough. It's the same in building anything or writing a book or building a company. You have to want it badly enough so that when it sucks, you still get up and you go and you push through. So you become a SEAL. You go off to Afghanistan. I mean, you do tours. You did, what was the ship that was bombed by the
USS Cole?
Oh man, that was terrible. I remember that. You were there, and then you know, Afghanistan, and then you've been in Iraq as a contractor.
Yep.
You know, you've done a bunch of, you know, stuff you can talk about and stuff you can't talk about. And then you get out. And, you know, this is always interesting to me because I know I have enough friends in the military who get out, and some of them go on to do like amazing things, right? And some get very lost, you know, and you and I have talked about this. It's like, it's the fact that, you know, my theory is that they don't have purpose. If you're no longer on mission, you know, we need to, you know, especially if we're used to being on mission and we lose them, we don't have that, what are we going to do? So you have to create your own.
Yeah.
You know, so you started a business, and like all best businesses, started small, started a blog that you grew, and you know, you wrote about what you knew and what you cared about.
Yeah, the reason I got into writing was it became very therapeutic. Even after I lost my first business, I started writing for magazines and I started blogging and then I realized like, this is like very therapeutic. But to be honest, like in hindsight, I probably would have chosen a less public, I would have put myself less in the public eye. But, you know, like hindsight is 20/20, right? Just the amount of criticism and it's a tough spot. Like all of us are, like I talked to Mark Luttrell, Rob O'Neill, all the SEAL authors. And I'm sure even Jocko gets it as well. Is when you put yourself in the public like that, you become like an easy target and scapegoat in many ways. And it has not been an easy path. Like I think back, I'm like, man, if I had just built and I love real estate. If I just built a real estate business and nobody would have cared, right? But the minute you're like, hey, I'm a Navy SEAL, this is my life story, you're fair game for the community. And I, you know, look, I'm proud of the service, and really, you know, outside of the deployments, my biggest contribution, and I've talked about it over and over, is my investment and sacrifice. I gave up my cushy shore assignment as a BUDS instructor to go teach snipers when I got recruited down there. And I, at the time, like, I just felt an obligation to do that, and then did that and became the sniper course manager. And then I was just burnt out. It's like time for me to move on. Business is freaking hard enough without kind of like taking the peanut gallery kind of criticism on the side, right? Like, you're dealing with real challenges and hiring and laying people off, losing sleep over payroll.
Most people who haven't done it don't understand the weight that you carry as a leader, you know, especially if you build something from scratch. You know, it's a friend of mine who's quite successful and is very much in the public eye and was taking a lot of heat. At one time he said, you know, in the end, his wife told him something. He's like, that let him sleep. She said, haters gonna hate.
Yeah, no, that's been a big lesson for sure.
And you know, it's like I heard Joe Rogan say, like, you think Michael Jordan reads his YouTube comments? You know, he's busy being Michael Jordan. You know, like, either busy doing shit or you're busy talking about people who are doing shit. It's always better to be doing shit.
And I think when I started to see this stuff happening in my own community, and it's like felt like we're eating each other alive, I kind of removed myself from the whole thing. And I think that, like, some guys, it made it even worse because they didn't have access to me anymore. But I just had to. Like, I just had to focus on the future, my family. You know, and there's many businesses where you can run a small business and have a great life. So I think the challenge of entrepreneurship is, like, what do you want to do? Like, what's your purpose? How do you want to build a big business? What kind of life do you want to have? Because I've thought about it. I'm like, man, if I could just go back and just buy a, you know, $5 million business and just chug it along. Like, in many ways, my mom did that with her partner. They built a coffee and tea manufacturing company. And I understand why they were older in their life. And they're like, we don't want to deal with we have enough issues dealing with 5 employees. Why would we want to, like, deal with all this other shit? So I kind of get it now, but it's really up to each of us to kind of to figure out that purpose, right? I just read that Viktor Frankl book.
Oh my God, Man's Search for Meaning, which
highly recommend to anybody.
Which, if you ever read, like, I've heard so many great public figures refer to that book as a life-changing book. And it really is.
It's a very
is.
Easy book to read, too. Powerful.
Yeah, he was an Austrian psychiatrist who was in Auschwitz during World War II. And he lost his family, his wife, everybody. He came out and wrote about what was the difference between the ones who survived and the ones who gave up and just died?
Yeah, his purpose in camp was to get out and make this better for other people, for humankind. Like, that became his
purpose. Just when you have purpose, it'll get you through anything.
Yeah. Right?
You know, like, whether it's entrepreneurship or SEAL training or Jesus, Auschwitz, you know, if you're lucky. So here's the thing. You've had, like, over, like, I think something like 500 episodes, right? So you're
almost at 500. Yeah.
It's amazing. So the people are listening here know you quite well. What is something about you that don't know that actually would be interesting or helpful to them?
I mean, I think, you know, as we're talking here about purpose, one of my big kind of, when I go to the well of purpose, it's around being a dad. You know, I don't have the traditional dad story, right? I'm divorced, father of three, kids live with their mom, but I have a great relationship with the mom and her husband, who they've had more children with. But I, like, the kids give me, when it's like all hell's breaking loose and, you know, just when you think you've had enough, like, something, some more bad news hits, it's always like, okay, I've, like, my purpose, I want to be a good dad and leave my kids in a really good spot where they're independent, self-sufficient. So, and I don't think I've talked too much about that before, but the kids are really important to me in my life and kind of really kind of set my true north, so to speak.
That's great, man. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
So we could, like, do many different episodes of different parts of our life.
No, dude, this has been nice. Yeah. And for those of you that listening, Kamal has offered to host a couple shows for us. So we're putting the schedule together now, but he has some really cool guests lined up to kind of fill in on the show. And this is kind of when Jack left the show, Nick Kaufman and I talked about kind of the direction we wanted to take the show, and we wanted to get back more into this, like, kind of storytelling and experience sharing, and less kind of into the foreign policy, political side, which is still, you know, happy to talk about that stuff. But I think it's like the last couple shows you guys have heard, the last show being I interviewed Todd Robinson and his new movie coming out, The Last Full Measure. This is the kind of direction we want to take the show. So hope you guys enjoyed the show, and you guys will be hearing from Kamal in the future. And again, if you want to follow Kamal, it's at Kamal Ravikant on Instagram. I'm at Brandon T. Webb on Instagram. And again, we're running that Crate Club summer sale on our Platinum Crate, and the code is CCSummer19. So if you're looking for a good gift for somebody for a birthday, or you want to get in for the holidays early and get a good deal on the Platinum Crate, you can go to Crate Club. I already announced this last show, but in case you missed it, we're basically consolidating all of our content, video, editorial, into one site. Pretty sure we're going to call it thecrate.com, but we'll stay tuned for that. That site will be up in late September. So excited to share that with you guys. Everything, aside from a special kind of team room member, like paid member experience, we'll have most of the content will be free. So excited about that, because we've had a lot of really good content we've kind of like kept hidden away for a long time. So anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed that show. Kamal, thanks for
my pleasure. And you know, I would say one thing, you know, my goal here is I've been in the military, and I'm fortunate to be where I'm in life, and I want to, you know, I love helping other veterans in any way I can. So I want to bring on guests that could actually help people either be better or make money or just whatever, like be better versions of themselves. So anything you think is of interest, just message us and let me know what kind of guests you'd want.
Awesome. All right. Thanks. Thanks, brother.
All right. Pleasure.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.